Switching Havens with Darkness, Darkness. It's from his 2009 album, Cuts to the Chase. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we begin the week with each other. And we are going to be talking about some pretty interesting stuff today, having to do with your own analysis. You see, this is what I stress. We don't have to wait for the experts. Okay, they know as much as we do. The idea is to become perfectly at ease with doing your own analysis, with doing your own inspection of the facts, and coming to conclusions because, as we've been talking about for quite some time on the program, it is going to fall to us to find a solution anyway. It's the work we have to do. And if we do it, it would be a major turn in our evolution as a society, and certainly in our evolution personally, that we don't have to wait to be handed the answers, because they probably won't be true anyway. We observe keenly, we listen, we look, we read, we put two and two together. More often than not, we will arrive at the number four. We'll get the answer. And of course, the events of the past week, certainly the past 2 weeks, should just accelerate our desire to get to that point of not waiting for the media to tell us what our reality is, not waiting for governmental officials to explain what is actually happening, what we see happening. You see it. So go with it and develop your skills to get better and better at analyzing your own reality. We've talked about the fact that the most important thing that we can have in our arsenal is clarity. When you're clear about a situation, you are also more better equipped to deal with it, arriving at a point of clarity. Now, what's going on here in this particular period that we're in? Of, it seems, warfare is breaking out all over the place. People are talking some really very scary talk, you know, in the name of their respective nations. They're waving, you know, their fists in the air and talking about annihilation and bombing and actually doing some bombing as a kind of right, as though they got permission from the people to do whatever it is they feel like they need to do. Well, President Donald Trump's unleashing the mother of all bombs, as they called it, last Thursday in Afghanistan, has exponentially broadened and deepened U.S. concurrent involvement in several theaters of war. We are at war. I mean, no matter how calm you think things are, no matter how much energy is put into creating a false narrative for us, we are at war. And it could get exponentially worse at any time. And I'm not saying this to be, you know, to scare anybody, including myself. I'm saying this is the objective fact. And no matter how hard the media signs on to this item on the agenda to calm the people down, to give us reason to believe that, hey, even if it's tough, we are the United States, for crying out loud. We'll get through it. No reason to be bothered about anything. But of course, we should be bothered because a lot of crazy stuff is happening in our name and without our permission. And despite our concerns, our legitimate concerns. We know that we have a very unsteady person in the White House who intends not to be accountable to anybody. He's doing whatever he wants to do. And we'll just have to eat the consequences of his rash actions. That's the prevailing attitude in Washington, D.C. Donald Trump is master and lord, and he can do whatever he wishes in the name of, you know, national security and the national interest. There seems to be little, if anything, that could put him in check. So apart from these concurrent involvements that we have going on, you can now, as of a couple of weeks ago, you can add ISIS to our, I shouldn't even claim our, to Trump's active enemies list. You can add Syria, you can add North Korea, and they look like that every day they're trumping up something, pardon that pun, to add to the enemies list, to the list of people that we are going to go after as a nation. Well, we need to ask some other questions. How and why did war become such a vital part of Donald Trump's agenda? How did we find ourselves mired in war all of a sudden? So the exercise I want us to do today is to think about this question. How and why has the country become enveloped in war? How did this happen? And why is it happening? I know you have quite a few very good answers out there, and we need to hear them because they will be valid answers, I think. And they will put us on to something else, and that is one of the things that we are very hesitant to do is to put things together. We see things as separate, discrete, unconnected activity. But of course, there is a choreography going on with a specific purpose, a specific intent, and in terms of where who is doing all of this choreography, a specific outcome. We just happen to be, you know, like a chessboard, you move the little pieces on the board at will. And increasingly, as citizens of this country, we get the feel that that's exactly what we are. We are pieces on a chessboard. We have no clue what the game is. We have no idea why we're being moved in this direction and that direction. But we see that in the end, the gamers, the people playing the game, all have one shared purpose and belief, and that is to win. Win at this game that we don't know that that they're playing or what the rules are, if any. We just get told to go over there or we pushed over there. We have no call. The apparatus of defense for us simply isn't working, if it exists at all. That too is part of the scenario that we have to consider. We are not able to apply the brake We have no system, no organized system of defense. And what we do have, as more than 120,000 people across the country yesterday decided to call publicly for Donald Trump to hand over his tax returns. Well, that is more symbolic than substantive. And I agree, just the same, that it was a good thing that they did. The sad fact of it is we have no real means, no effective means, no legal means or rights to compel him to do something that we, the people, want him to do. We have an ineffective political opposition, and so we're stuck. But I'm hoping that at least while we try to figure things out, we begin to seek clarity about the situation that we're in. And that would help us to formulate a response. We have to formulate a response as a collective, as the people of this nation, and we certainly have to formulate a response on an individual level. We've got to have our own personal response, because that will determine how and if we survive in this time and beyond it. All right. I will give you a clue to start our exercise today. And this clue comes from General H.R. McMaster, who is now the in charge of national security. I want you to listen to this very, very, very carefully. This is an excerpt, I should say, of a talk he gave in 2014 at the Carnegie Council. And he was talking about the mistakes, the errors, he said, that were made politically and militarily in Vietnam. And the main thing was that there was no strategy, nor was there consideration of the long-term effect of the war and its costs, human costs and material costs. But what is important about this is that you see the direct line that you can reasonably draw about his thinking in his current situation as the National Security Agency advisor to Donald Trump. And what you can see is a striking parallel between the conditions at the time of the Vietnam War and conditions that exist now as the United States ramps up its war machine. He is a soldier, so he's talking as a soldier, but he's also saying something very strikingly important. And that is the conjoining of effort between politics and the military. It's a short piece, but in my view, it is very, very instructive. So here is General H.R. McMaster, the guy who is guiding Trump.
Period of time, as Vietnam became an American war, as President Johnson was thrust into the presidency after the assassination of President Kennedy in November of 1963, the president was motivated mainly by two things. One, to become elected in his own right in 1964, and then to pass, you know, the Great Society legislation in 1965. He viewed Vietnam principally as a danger to those domestic political goals. And so what he wanted was advice from the military that would allow him to make decisions on Vietnam that did not place those goals in jeopardy. And so even though it was clear to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and many others that it was time for a decision, a clear decision between an American war and disengagement from Vietnam, that sort of discussion really didn't even take place. And so what happened is the president's advisors and the Secretary of Defense in particular, they developed a strategy to meet the president's concerns. And that was a strategy of so-called graduated pressure. It was based on a fundamentally flawed assumption that limited military actions, covert actions against North Vietnam under Op Plan 34A, beginning in January of 64, and then limited bombing strikes against Vietnam, North Vietnam, would convince Ho Chi Minh and the North Vietnamese leadership to desist from its support for the Vietnamese communists in the South. Now, there are all sorts of problems with this thinking, right? One of the problems was mirror imaging, you know, the enemy. And in fact, applying in this case, you know, the rational man theory of English common law to Ho Chi Minh. In fact, there were memos written in this period of time that they would establish a common law pattern of attacks to convince Ho to do the rational thing. And so, of course, this misunderstands, again, the nature of war. And the fourth continuity of nature of war I didn't mention is war is a contest of wills, right? And war and acts of war unleash a psychological dynamic, you know, that really don't allow you to have any kind of rational prediction of what the future course of events are going to be. The other thing, and we see this even today, you know, when we think about the application of standoff, long-range capabilities to war, is that really when you take standoff actions against an enemy, you are leaving decisions in the hands of that enemy, what they're going to do next. And so the only way you can really compel an outcome is to have the military force able to compel the outcome. And this is consistent with Thomas Schelling's, you know, writings about coercive forces, is that it's that brute force option that makes those actions short of that brute force option more effective in the area of dissuasion or coercive diplomacy. And so really, from that point on, the Vietnamese communists and Ho had the initiative and responded in ways that I think were actually eerily predictable. I mean, there were war games run in 1964, the Sigma war games, that were eerily prophetic in predicting, you know, the future course of events in the war. What happened, though, is that the president and the Secretary of Defense did not want their best military advice from the chiefs. In fact, in a phone call to Lyndon Johnson during when all these decisions were being made, he says to the president, "Hey, I'm taking a divide-and-conquer approach with the chiefs, and it's coming along pretty well." Essentially telling him, hey, you're not going to get really effective advice from them. And so what he was trying to do was keep them divided so that they wouldn't give him advice that could be used against his policy. He wanted to prevent any kind of a policy debate. And he was deceiving the American people about the nature of America's commitment. I mean, it was not only counterproductive, right, because it really removed what could have been an important corrective to what was, at least in retrospect, an unwise policy. But it was undemocratic. I mean, it was a deliberate circumvention of the Constitution of the United States. And the chiefs, I think, and the criticism, I think, the chiefs at the time, and their own criticisms of each other later, was that they were a party to that, because instead of drawing out the long-term costs and consequences of the war in a way that we would help the president make that decision, they instead took a foot-in-the-door approach, right? Go along with this graduated pressure, get the first bombing runs off, get the first troops committed, under the idea that they would be able to argue over time for a more resolute application of force and the resources necessary to achieve the outcome. And so this manifested itself during several meetings. I mean, one of them is, I think, quite revealing, in which the chiefs say, hey, it's going to take, you know, take at least 100,000 troops to make a difference. This is in the summer of 1965. And the president says, I can't give you 100,000 troops. And then goes the next chief, what do you think, 100,000 troops? He goes, I can't give you 100,000 troops. Mothers would come out of their kitchens and take their aprons off, he said. And he turned to Robert McNamara, who was sitting next to him, and he said, let me tell you a story. He said, imagine that you're in a small town and you have a business, and you need to keep your business afloat, and you need to go to the bank for your loan, and it's Mr. McNamara's bank. And you go to the bank and you say, hey, I need $100,000 to keep my business going. And Mr. McNamara tells you, I can't give you $100,000, but I can give you $5,000. What do you do? Take the $5,000 and do the best you can, or just let your business go under? And so this is how, you know, we went to war without a strategy. This is how we confused activity with progress in the Vietnam War and didn't consider long-term costs and consequences.
Okay. Now, that should be very, very instructive in terms of informing your opinions about where we are with all this recent bombing that we've been doing and the appearance that Donald Trump, the commander-in-chief, has turned something of a corner in terms of his approach to warfare. All right, so here's what you do. You put that little piece of information, because it's loaded with a number of things that would help us understand the attitude of Donald Trump and his administration, the attitude of the military, and in a longer sense, a more long-term sense, we can surmise what is at work here, where this is leading to. So I could open up the phones, 888-874-4888, and we can begin this conversation, because a lot was conveyed in that short time that has to do with our current situation. What do you think that McMaster means about this wrong attitude about war? And therefore, what do you suspect is being done now with all these bombings? What do you suspect is happening? These aren't just bombings, blindsiding bombings. There is a particular purpose here. There's a particular reason here. And of course, we know that McMaster is new to the job. He was appointed after General Flynn was invited to leave the administration. But what are we hearing here? And therefore, what could we expect to happen in the very near future and for quite a while, perhaps even beyond Donald Trump's term of office? I'll give you another hint. He says that when you get involved in standoff actions, he's also, by the way, referring to the presidents that came before Donald Trump. You know, since the days of Vietnam until now, the inference is by him that presidents took a very bad approach to war. A piecemeal way of fighting a war that he says, when you fight wars that way, you leave decisions in the hands of the enemy that you're fighting. Critical decisions. The idea, he says, is to deal with the enemy with brute force action. You don't give them any chance to make a decision, a subsequent decision after a first piecemeal attack. You need brute force action. What have we been seeing? What did we see just last Thursday? The mother of all bombs. Did it actually kill? Was the kill rate that high? No. It was meant to exhibit brute force and therefore to change people's minds, the minds of the people being targeted, the countries and the groups being targeted, about this new kind of war that the United States is fighting. But let's get back to the subject of what does this little piece of information that we just learned, that there's so many things that were said here. How do you see it shaping the U.S. approach to war and even shaping or reshaping the administration's position and posture? But mind you, I do remind you that it doesn't seem that the United States has any kind of plan at all with respect to the people attacked with bombs and being threatened to be attacked with bombs. So what is it that we are witnessing here? Phil from Brooklyn, let's start with you.
Well, hi there. How you doing today?
Oh, fine. Thank you, Chris. How about you?
I'm doing fine. I kind of see it as I see things that happen on the local level, say, like with the police, in terms of what they do in communities of color. So they use this, it's basically like a bullying concept, right? So what they'll do, they'll use overwhelming force, they'll intimidate people. And so all of this is about creating a certain kind of psychology or notions of the people that don't have the power to think and act in a certain kind of way. That's what McMaster's talk sort of said to me.
I think you're right.
And
he said it is a contest of wills, right? And contest of wills, you must leave no room for doubt that you are going to apply brute force action, because this eliminates any possibility that you may misread the message that is coming at you, the intended target, that is. So what did we see in the past week that suggests that this is the tactic that Trump's administration is adopting?
Well, I kind of look at it as a continuum. So, we have Trump with this kind of overt actions and also words. But we also have, like, the Obama administration with overt actions, but different words.
But the Obama administration, this was his implication in this short talk, that successive administrations, going back to the Vietnam era until now, had made this and other fatal mistakes. And that is why there has been no resolution to these wars. And the way you win a war, from his perspective, he's a soldier, the way you win a war is you inflict maximum damage and you leave no room for doubt that it could only escalate.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, I mean, this is kind of like, this is kind of old school thinking, though, is what is, you know, this is like primitive.
Well, he says old school thinking in terms of U.S. approaches and policies toward war has been a gradual approach, and that is not going to work, he says. That didn't work. It's not going to work. The only way that the United States can prevail in the world of war is to be resolute and to exert maximum brute force.
Oh, yeah. Well, when I say old school, I mean, like, this is how people that want to exert power over people, this is what they do. I mean, you know, on the domestic level, say in a household, to, you know, the police departments, to, you know, corporate, this is how things operate. You know, in a typical prison situation, they use maximal force to keep down rebellions and to keep the prisoners in check, just so that they know who's boss.
What does this do for Donald Trump? And what does it do for the people?
Well, I think what it does for Donald Trump, it sort of shores up this notion that a lot of people that voted for him, that he's, you know, the tough guy that's ready to, like, act and do stuff. You can kind of see this in his rallies when, there was somebody that was trying to get close to him or whatever. He's, like, reacting, But, you know, this is sort of like an extension of that.
But he also said that even going all the way back to the Vietnam War, there were no cogent plans, and that seems to be the case right now.
Oh, yeah, because it's all for show. It's all about the psychological factor. That's why.
Hmm. All right. Well, you seem to have a hang of this. Let me ask you one final question here.
Sure.
Having heard this, and of course, much of this is not necessarily new, but it is interesting in the way that McMaster combined the theory of war and the practice of war as a tactician with the idea that policy, you also have to have a clear policy. So he's saying that, is it a case where war is shaped by policy or policy shapes war?
Oh, war is, you know, war is, because, you know, war is just the means to the end of whatever policy that you want to put forth. So if I want something from you, and if I can't negotiate it to get it from you, and I feel powerful enough, I could take it from you.
Okay. What, therefore, do you expect to happen, or where is this conversation and the points made in this conversation, where are these things likely to show up as policy in the very near future?
I kind of see a some kind of, you know, more exertions of force, more provocations, and, you know, I mean, I don't want to sound like, you know, all gloom and doom, but, you know, this country is actually, you know, it's steaming to war because it's under the notion that it could beat everybody.
Hmm. Well, thank you, Phil, and you it was a comfort to know that you're thinking and putting these things together. And I think you're on the right track. Thank you so much.
Right,
we'll follow up, of course, and figure out where we are along this line of discussion. Thanks so much. Chris, you're next. You're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon, Utrice. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. And good afternoon to you.
Really interesting points you've brought up. It really requires like a two-hour seminar for this. I just want to start off by saying, it's interesting to me, and I've had this discussion with other people, you know, because I used to teach English as a second language, and I had an opportunity to meet people from South America, a lot of Europeans, some people from Africa, and some Asians, you know, generally. So point being that, you know, I was exposed to having that one-on-one with people from all over the world, and it's interesting how much you can sort of pick up. Obviously, it's a different setting because, you know, you get a lot of powerful people otherwise, and when they're in a room with you and you're, you know, trying to convey a way of, you know, speaking another language that is not their first, you know, there's a different relationship. But it was interesting how much, if you listen carefully and you care a little bit, how much you pick up their intellectual sort of, how can I say it? I don't want to sound pretentious, but the way they understand things to be. And it's funny about American society, and I'm generalizing, and I live here. This is my country. I'm an American citizen. You know, I don't mean to, it's not personal, but when you look at the country as an entity, and the way that you would look at one person and say, like, you know, he or she has this personality, they have these tendencies. So this is where I'm coming from when I say this. It's a turnoff, because when you see and you listen, even if you listen to politicians when they're interviewed, there's this presumption of knowledge that the American narrative contains, or Americans have, and when I say Americans, I mean politically speaking, okay, that they have this presumption of knowledge of knowing what's better for the other. You know, it's almost like you have to understand, you know.
We heard this in reference to the piece just played with McMaster, saying that essentially people are given, including the presidents now, he was saying this specifically to the presidents, being given false information. Now, I thought that was interesting because he was specifically referring to the Vietnam War era, that the generals even, and he talked about mirroring where the assumption is that, and this he considered a flaw, where the Army, the U.S. military, would consider or assume that the armies that they're fighting have their values, mirror their values. And he says that that was a major, major flaw. But he talked about the fact that the generals were giving the presidents bad information or wrong information or misinformation, and that this was a major problem. Now, what do you make of that?
Well, you know, a military person, and I don't mean just a common soldier, I mean those people who push the buttons, okay, they're coming from a particular place. They have a certain premise, so to speak. You know what I mean? It's like I would say, for example, the Olympic Games, let's just say, right? There's a common premise there of all people who are participants. Some people are taller, some are shorter, some have longer legs. And when they decide to participate in a race, a relay, okay, they know that they might not win because somebody else has longer legs. But the point is that they are competing all, but they have a common premise. Okay, they have certain rules that they have to abide by. And this is it. I think what happens here very often is when you're listening to a military person, and this ties into the American, what I was saying earlier about the American way of seeing and what how you feel yourself to be or who you are as an American, you know. A lot of what's going on over the years, it's Americans that want and need to win. Okay? Now, you can say to me, well, every country wants to win, and of course that would be true. Okay? It sounds like a platitude, but if you think about it a little bit, all right, even if you look again at the Olympic Games, if you go back to previous games, now, obviously, every country, especially a powerful country like the U.S., and we have wonderful athletes here, you know, when they televise the Olympic Games, of course they're going to focus on their own athletes and their own games. But there are so many games in the Olympics that that people would be interested in seeing, since it is an international event and since it is supposed to be fair for all countries. You know what I mean? This is supposed to be an apolitical thing. This is where it started from, the idea that you competed without any political intentions. And the thing is that Americans need to win. They have to win. The idea of losing is not acceptable to them. It's not acceptable. This is the premise that they go on, okay?
Now, could I ask you to get a little bit microscopic here? And it is an extraordinarily strong point that you're making. America needs to win. Substitute the word America for Donald Trump. And what do we see then, the connection that McMaster is making three years ago, with this very brief piece that I played, and Donald Trump, recently elected, wanting to win. Why does he need to win? Why does he need this to win?
Well, let me tell you, my position on Donald Trump, and this is my own, it's a visceral thing, but it's also intellectual. I don't see Donald Trump as having any, he does not have an ideology. The fact that he ran in on the Republican ticket, he had to run on one ticket because otherwise he would not have been a major player. So, and we know that from knowing even Bernie Sanders, who ran on a major ticket. He needed to be either a Democrat or a Republican. If you listen to a lot of what he said, there is nothing that he said that he didn't flip on, but he was pretty strong regarding the wars, and I think a lot of people voted for him because they saw, well, okay, this man may be whatever he is, but at least there is a possibility with him, unlike Hillary Clinton, that maybe he might take the foreign policy of the United States in a little bit of a different direction. He doesn't have an ideology. I don't know, maybe he didn't expect to win this presidency. As the way I see him now, I know that he's president. I find it difficult to come out and say, and this is not in defense of him, I'm just saying that I find it difficult to say, well, he's responsible for this, because that's what they're telling us. That's who we are presented, that this is the person that you point your finger at. I don't see that. You understand, within my head and my mind, in my mind's eye, I don't see him there. They are pulling his strings. That's why he is allowed to stay. If he did not agree to this, he would not be allowed to stay. I mean,
who are the they that are pulling his strings?
Well, I mean the military and the Pentagon.
Okay. So you see what we very, very close here. If I could interject and add on to what you have said, and you are absolutely on point. Donald Trump doesn't have an ideology. The military gives him one. And the military gives him an ideology that says you got to win. And you can't win by any other means except, really, brute force. Because if you do the namby-pamby approach that Barack Obama did and others did that left so much power with the people that you're attacking, the divide-and-conquer thing is not working. You're going to have to go in full blast. And this is why we have this, the bombings.
That's
Donald
right.
Trump's major initiatives so far within his first 100 days have yielded very little in the way of success. His major pushes against Obamacare and other items that were on his to-do list within the first 100 days all have failed. He needs the kind of thinking, which is why he shuffled his Steve Bannon is next to go. He has gone through a mad reshuffling of the people in his close circles because he doesn't think he's hearing the right thing. Here comes McMaster. And he's saying the right thing as far as Donald Trump is concerned. He says, I'm going with him. And what is McMaster saying? He talked about that instance in which, look, you got to be well equipped. You can't go in there taking on a war in which you have to do if you want certain things to be successful, you have to do certain things. We need soldiers. That's why, 2 weeks ago, we reported that there was movement in Syria and that 150,000 troops were already beginning to be moved in that direction. So you see how these are the things he's talking here. We're listening to him talk in 2014. 3 years ago, and we see the applicability and the connection between that and what is happening, what has happened in the last 2 weeks. And now today we hear from North Korea that in defiance, they will be testing missiles every week. In other words, it has gone up a notch. See, so you were absolutely perfect in your analysis today, and I'm glad that you were able to share it the way you did it, very conversationally, but it was intense teaching. Thank you so much. Thank you. Khalil from South Carolina, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Chief. How are you today?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. I'm great.
Yes, you are.
That. Listen, the last caller, she was on point.
Yep.
And she's the one who provoked me to call because when she mentioned presumed knowledge, I kind of synthesized that into something that's a pet peeve of mine, which is manifest destiny. And in my mind, it has a very negative connotation to it in how America has gotten where we are and how we operate. And it seems to be a certain group of folks who end up in power in this country who subscribe to manifest destiny. And it often seems to get us in trouble.
Could I ask you, from the point of view of, I hate to even use the word policy because he doesn't have one, but the Trump administration's posture on this issue of war and dealing with quote, the enemy, unquote, and the shuffling around. Did you see any connection here between what was said by McMaster and what Trump has done in recent weeks in preparation for war and in conducting war?
Well, yes. Obviously, Trump was not, yes, and this all has to do with Trump wanting to win because he is needy. He needs an ego stroking constantly, and most of us know that, and that's one of the main problems. But, yes, people, if you look back in history, believe General Westmoreland, well, it was a number of generals, but they mostly relied to LBJ about how many troops it would take to win this war, and we can do this, and we can win this. Just give us more revenue and more troops, and we can do this. And Trump wants to win, so maybe McMaster is saying that, you know, the last, I know you had some substandard folks before me, but I'm the one. I can do this. I'm sober. You know, these other guys, Flynn, you see what he was about. You wanted Petraeus, even though he was a traitor, but, you know, he was willing to overlook that. I don't know if I'm on the same plane as you are with this, but it's just so complicated when you have a mentally unstable person in charge who is willing. I mean, most of us, he's willing to do anything to get a win. He has no legislation, or he's sponsored no legislation at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm not trying to get too far off, but you see, that this is tainting. The fascist in charge is not stable, okay? And he has got unstable people around him.
Do you think that Donald Trump has undergone some kind of a change in terms of, you know, he had, because of his ego, he had an idea of what he could and couldn't accomplish in a short time. Piece of cake. And now he has been slammed into a wall of reality about what it takes to get certain things done. And he realizes now that he's in trouble because, just like you said, the personnel in his mind that he has to work with, they're not going to be able to do the job. Do you get a feeling that he has undergone some kind of a, for lack of a better term, because I agree with our first caller, that he doesn't have an ideology? He has no ideology except winning. Do you get a feeling, though, that he is undergoing or has undergone some kind of a change in terms of his thinking here?
Oh, that's an interesting word when you use it in the same context with that person. Yes, because, you know, because yes, well, he's had a very truncated session, a primer in how things work in government, because he had no idea. He thought he could just come in and say, okay, this is what you're going to do. We're going to do this. You know, get rid of Obamacare. He doesn't understand process in terms of how our government works, but he's learning. So now he's got to get the tools, and when I say tools, I mean personnel who will help him implement some things that will make him look successful, because he really does not have too much of an ideology. Yeah, he's slightly. No, he doesn't have any ideology, no. And it's the mental illness, and I hate to keep saying that, but it's just so sad to have someone who is so weak and someone so ignorant who touts that they do not read. And then to become president.
A feather in his cap. He does not read.
Okay. But, and I don't know if I got where you were leading me, but.
No, you're doing fine. I'm just trying to see how you put the pieces together. And do they make sense to you? Do these things that exist in their own individual worlds, do they come together in a way that gives you a bit more clarity about where we are?
Okay, two things very quickly. Number one, I'm not quite sure that the intelligence agencies are going to give him all the correct information because of the way he started out with them. Number one, because most of those people are full-time workers. A lot of those people are full. In other words, they're going to be around when Trump leaves. He's part-time. And they know he's dangerous. The other the other side of that coin is that maybe some of the information they have given him, maybe he sees how delicate the situation is with the world right now, and it has sobered him up slightly. He's not tweeting as much. So he's having to recalibrate, okay? But he's still full of problems. This Sean Spicer thing, I don't even know how he still has a job. That's ridiculous. That's a whole other show.
What do you think is likely to happen? Because we see no real opposition coming from Congress. Especially, one would imagine that a situation involving war, and now it's becoming more and more global in scope, one would imagine that Congress would be hopping, breathing down his throat about, what do you think you're doing here? And they have no part in this. Does that bother you?
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, we need to reread. War is a Racket by Smedley Butler, and it's free on, I believe it's Gutenberg Press. If you go there, you can get the ebook for free. It's a quick read. So a lot of these folks in Congress have stock or they have interest in defense contracts because that's our only growth industry. We don't really make anything anymore. We make cars. You know, and we make bombs and tanks, and they're overpriced and expensive. So, this is where their motivations lie. They want to use Trump as a vehicle to get what they want before they throw him away. And I just feel sorry for America because we have so many ignorant people in this country now, and it's becoming so evident. And it's one thing to be ignorant, but to be ignorant and have no interest in improving yourself. And then to be loud about it. You know,
ignorant,
you're really ignorant.
And arrogant. Bad combination.
Bad. Thank you, Yatrice.
Thank you, Khalil, for your call today. Yvette from the Bronx, you're on the air.
Yes. What I got from that little piece was that, number one, it appeared to me that he's saying back when, we had the war, Vietnam War, that the president was afraid that the women in the kitchen would take off their aprons and give him all hell. So he didn't want to go through a process that the military was going to suggest. So that's where the politics came in. And I think what he's saying now, like, let's forget about the politics, let's just go for the military and forget the Congress, forget all of this. There's a strategy that needs to be taken militarily. And that's what I got from
it. The point, he was making the point, I think, that the role of the military back in the Vietnam era was to help the president, Lyndon Johnson, achieve his political agenda.
Right.
And as long as they kept that as part of the main perspective, they were free to conduct the war however they wanted to, a very unscientific approach to conducting war. Now he says wars have to be fought with a different approach, which is to keep politics at center. It's not incidental. The politics are at center, and maybe this is what attracts Trump.
A different feel. I'm figuring that the president was telling the military back then, look, you can't do A, B, and C. That was the strategy that he said was missing. Because what did you get from that point when he said the women would take the aprons off?
Well, I got from that there would be something of a revolt coming from,
the people.
An unexpected quarter. People who normally were not going to be involved in these kinds of actions will revolt.
Right.
And throw the issue right back where the generals would not have wanted it to be.
Right. So now I'm thinking today he's saying forget about the people who want to revolt, who wants to put pressure on Congress to do certain things. Forget about them. Let's just do it militarily and forget all of that. That's what I got from what he said.
I think you're right. I think that's what he said. War is a contest of wills, he says. And if you are on the side, especially on the side of the aggressor, you must intend to win, and you are allowed to exercise maximum brute force, he says, in order to win.
That's right.
And that's how we should. That was just a nice little window into the events of the last 2 weeks.
Right.
The attempt by the military to reshape how wars are to be won, how wars are to be conducted, maximum brute force.
Right. And so then, therefore, you don't give your enemy a chance by saying, "Oh, let's hold back. Just go in there and just bomb them up. That's it." And so doing, I'm looking at also the protests that was carried on, and I think the protest was, I don't know. I just think it has nothing to do with what's going on now. His inability.
Well, in a way, it does. I'll tell you why. Because what they're raising is the question of the integrity of the commander in chief. You're breaking the law, and to what degree, therefore, are you qualified to be in that position? We, the people, need to know. Well, that brings us to the end of the program today. I am so delighted to have had the participation of such very brainy people, and you can see how things that look as if they're totally unconnected actually have a very deep connection, and it puts us close to the very elusive at this point. What the heck is going on in this man's head? And how is it possible that people could think that this is a normal situation? And how is it that we're not getting a response in Congress that we ought to be getting, given the seriousness of the moment that we're in? Stay tuned. Coming up next, Meditations and Molotovs with Vincent Emanuele. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. And we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Darkness, darkness, be my pillow.